Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the CloudOnAut podcast. My name is Andreas, and today I'm joined by two special guests, John Culkin and Mike Zazun. We are on a mission to explore Amazon Web Service. So listen to the CloudOnAut podcast to deepen your AWS knowledge, stay up to date, and be inspired. This is episode 45, and we are recording this on April 7th, 2020. This podcast in particular, and CloudOnAut in general, is only possible through donations from our supporters. So thanks to Alan Leach, Alex Dupree, Jason Yorty, Jeff Finlay, Jay Hortley, Jura Martinka, Ken Snyder, Torsten Huger, Todd Valentine, and all the anonymous supporters for your help. Please consider becoming a supporter of our work as well. You'll find all the details at cloudonaut.io. Support us as well in the show notes. So, John and Mike, back to you. So it seems like your story began at CloudReach, where you both worked as cloud architects back in 2018, something like that. And nowadays, you both are working as senior solution architects for Amazon Web Service. Did I summarize your journey correctly, or did I miss something?
That's a pretty good summary. We're lucky enough to know each other at two jobs that have a lot of great experience together, learned a lot of things, so that helped us get here today.
So perfect. And on top of that, you have decided to write a book together. So the book is called The AWS Cookbook. So could you tell us a little bit on what led you to do so? So why did you decide to take such a crazy project and write a book?
I can take that one. John and I spent a lot of time working together with customers, and there was always some recurring themes, and really we identified just a common need that we saw just for nice, concise examples of how to do certain things in AWS. And people really appreciated when we would work with them directly. And we thought, what if we could maybe do that at a broader scale? Just very quick quick and powerful solutions to certain little problems and challenges you might run into. So we saw a need there, and it was a really fun project to go through.
Perfect. So I'm currently writing the third edition of the book that I've written together with Michael, my brother, AWS in Action. So, and that's why I'm interested in the experience of writing a book. So what was the process like for you? How long did it take from start to the book having the publisher publishing the book? What did you learn on the way? What were the obstacles? So I think many of our listeners are also very interested in learning about the process of writing a technical book.
I'm sure, as you know, it's challenging and it is a lot of work. It took us maybe around a year and a half, I think, Mike, and there were some ups and downs and changes along the way. One big change that we had was the CDK updated from 1 to 2, and we used the CDK a little bit in the book, so I had to go back and rewrite some code. But some things that worked well for us were just consistently working at the book. So setting a goal, even if it's 100 words a day, if it's 2 lines of code, you have to just to get started and just get moving, and you'll find more come out. One of the models I had that I think we used a little bit was write with fire, edit with ice. So sometimes you just need to throw words on paper, and then you need to come back when you're in a different mindset to really edit those and crystallize them a little bit.
To definitely echo that one, we got a lot of progress there, and our Jeff Barr, he wrote our foreword. We graciously thank him for that, and he gave us a tip kind of early on as well. And once we established our final form, really how we wanted to present each recipe, once we had that framework, the whole process really just fell into place. It was nice to have our just that pattern, and the solutions became very clear how we wanted to present each recipe. So that was really good advice we got from Jeff on there.
Perfect. Thanks for sharing your story there. So before we start looking more detailed into the book, so I expect that what you've written in the book is probably what you learned in your day-to-day work. Could you maybe share a little bit about how your typical workday looks like, what you're working on. So where are all these learnings coming from, basically? That's what I'm interested in.
Want to start with that one, John?
Sure. And I think you're mostly correct there with that assumption, but I'll only modify it that, you know, the majority, I think, of the recipes are things that we've learned in the past and have explained to customers and really felt were foundational knowledge or really some nice to know knowledge, some tips and tricks, if you will, that we really wanted to impart as part of the book. But we really wanted to learn while we were creating this book. So there's some recipes that we picked out that we originally didn't know about, and we used the book writing process as a way to really to learn new recipes. What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, for sure. There were definitely a few, especially, you know, in maybe the AI ML section, where I really day-to-day don't interact with those services quite as much. But when we uncovered what was possible there in just a few short steps, it was really amazing. You know, going through and being able to redact PII from a document automatically with Comprehend or transcribe a podcast, just some of those really quick solutions there were really easy, and it was pretty clear why that was powerful to show, and really gave me a lot of ideas on how to possibly use those day to day, even though I don't really pick those up, you know, during my day work with AWS.
Okay, so that means your day work at AWS is it consulting clients, or what is what you're doing in your day work?
I work, as you mentioned, Mike and I previously worked at CloudReach, an AWS partner. I now work in the partner organizations, kind of on the other side of that partner fence, if you will. So I help partners really envision aligned business solutions to AWS services and then deliver those. So really helping partners deliver for customers. So a little bit different for me, but Mike's in a little bit different role now.
I do work in AWS's professional services organization, specifically with financial services customers. And my role as an architect is to work directly with customers on their migrations or optimizations. And I do work directly with our customers. Most oftentimes, right next to partners as well.
Okay, but writing the book is basically what you do in your free time. Is that correct? So this is a side project that you're doing outside of work?
Yes.
Wow. Well, then congratulations on the achievement, because doing all that beside a day job is maybe, probably, or is even more impressive, I would say, for everyone who has tried writing a book.
A lot of late nights.
Absolutely. Okay, so thanks for sharing a little bit about yourself. And next, I want to dive into the AWS cookbook a little bit more. So I had a look through the cookbook, and what I noticed right away is it really feels like a cookbook. So because you find a lot of different recipes in there, and you can just go through the book and find what's out of interest for you, or what might fit into your mood or something like that. So I really enjoy the format. So can you share maybe a little bit about the way the book is structured and your intention with that?
I can take a stab at that one. You know, the intent there is really, it's really hard to write a book that covers everything in AWS. But so we narrowed the scope down just to some high-level categories that are pretty common. And then really our intent was to be able to pick up the book and turn to any page, or the start of any recipe, I should say, and be able to go through it without prior knowledge. So we really give all of the context that you would need to go through. Even if you haven't had much experience with a certain area, you could just pick it up, go through, just like you would a cookbook, where maybe you turn to the middle and you could make a Mediterranean dish, or maybe go to the last chapter and make some pizza. Give a reader everything they need to get a certain scenario done, no matter where they pick up in the book. If you read through it sequentially, you know there might be some value there, but really being able to pick it up anywhere, however you're feeling that day, was our intent.
Yeah, we loved O'Reilly's kind of cookbook series and the general format that it presented. One, because of all the things Mike said, but the only thing I would add was I loved how it starts out with a problem statement. Because a lot of times we look at these AWS services as a lot of great, fantastic building blocks that can be assembled in and put into action, as you would agree. So we wanted to really set out initially to define what we were trying to solve, talk about how we solved it, go about solving it and the steps, and then talk about it with a discussion that says, here's why we made those choices. Here's why you might have a different scenario in your day-to-day life at your customer, at your client, at your work. And then we finish each recipe with a challenge. So if you really like that, or if you wanted to, you know, think about a way to extend it, we offer a challenge to really let the reader go off on their own.
Perfect. Yeah, I really like the format as well. So, and the good news for our listeners is that you are bringing some of your recipes to this podcast episode. So basically, this will be a short excerpt of the book in audio form. So that's really, really cool. I'm really looking forward to that. One of the recipes is about testing IAM policies with the IAM policy simulator. So I would really appreciate if you would walk us through this recipe.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll go through this recipe, talk about how it comes together. We can present as you would read in the book, and hopefully we can provide a link out where you can actually access a free copy of this recipe and several others.
Absolutely. You will find all that in the show notes. Check that out.
Fantastic. So testing IAM policies with the IAM policy simulator. So we start with a problem statement. So you have an IAM policy that you would like to put into use, but you would also like to test its effectiveness first. This is a great pattern to start to learn. So the solution we present is attach an IAM policy to an IAM role and simulate the actions with the IAM policy simulator. And we provide a solution figure image that you can see how everything comes together. So step one, we create a file that is a assume role policy, and we provide the content for you. And we also provide this file pre-built for you in our GitHub repository. You'll find a link to that in the show notes.
So basically, this is for me. So just I'm just thinking about, so when is it important to do so? So this is when I have the task of coming up with an IAM policy, let's say for an application that runs on EC2 or Lambda. And I want to make sure that the IAM policy that I defined is really what I need. So I basically can now simulate the API calls that I want to do with the help of that solution to make sure I can test it a little bit before I actually run something in my AWS account. Is that a good summary?
That's exactly right. So we actually show how to build this role, and eventually we'll give some validation steps, which will let you make some mock calls using the IAM policy simulator. And the policy simulator will report back to you to say, this call was allowed. And conversely, we'll show a call that's not allowed. And it'll tell you why the call isn't allowed with the results.
Okay, so that's very interesting. Actually, I learned about the possibility to do so yesterday, because I didn't know that there's an API for that. So very, very interesting. So how do I use the simulator? What do I have to do to get that running?
So really, we create a file. It's called an assume role policy. And then we actually provide this in our repository. And we then create a role using that assume role policy. This role is going to eventually have a role policy that we attach a managed policy to. It's the Amazon EC2 read-only access policy, and the result of running through the steps to build this is you'll have a role with a single policy attached that is the Amazon EC2 read-only access managed policy. That will let us run through some validation checks that we can use the IAM policy simulator with to see which actions might be permitted and which actions might not be permitted. So our first validation step that we run after we attach the EC2 read-only access is to try to test against the EC2 create internet gateway action. So we're going to tell the IAM policy simulator to say, is this action allowed with the role that we created? And so passing EC2 create internet gateway in outputs an implicit deny. So that's telling us that we haven't actually granted the ability to create an internet gateway with this role. We've only given it EC2 read-only access. So this is expected behavior, and the policy simulator is telling us that indeed that create internet gateway action is not allowed.
Yeah, this is great, because these are some scenarios you might see at a customer site. Maybe a developer isn't comfortable with AWS yet, and they really want to make sure that they don't have the ability to attach an internet gateway to a VPC for some compliance or security concern. So great little CLI command to really specify the policy and then the action you're trying to simulate, and see what the result was without actually trying it.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's worth mentioning here again. So basically, what you can do with the simulator is you have the AWS CLI allows you to call to simulate calls to the AWS APIs, in this case the EC2 API, with a certain IAM role, and then you get the result back. What would happen if you do the call? What would IAM say? Would it allow or deny the specific actions? That's really interesting, and you can simulate all of that with the AWS command line interface, which I find very interesting. That's really, really helpful.
You could see how this could be extended into compliance as code framework or pipeline, if you will, to make sure that specific actions are not allowed by any roles that you create and policies that you then attach to them. So really giving you that confidence that there wasn't an implicit deny or even an explicit deny if your policy had that in it. So really a lot of ways you could take them. And the challenge we give for this recipe is to simulate the effect of a permissions boundary on an IAM principle. So moving beyond IAM roles and policies a different way, pretty slick.
So the thing is, the simulator not only works for basically basic IAM permissions with a role and a policy, it works with permission boundaries as well. Does it also work with service control policies?
It does. So we actually get into that into the discussion a little bit after you run through the validation checks. So it works with identity-based policies, IAM permissions boundaries, service control policies, and also resource-based policies. So you can really use it at quite a broad scale to simulate actions.
Okay, so you could even make sure, for example, let's say your application really depends on accessing data on S3. You could even use that to make sure that any changes that you make do not break the application accessing the data or something like that. So that could be really helpful as part of a deployment pipeline, that you make sure you're not breaking your systems with all those complex configurations, SCPs, permission boundaries, and so on, which is quite interesting, probably also for administrators of AWS organizations that are responsible for those SCPs, because I've seen enterprises failing when rolling out those SCPs without thoughtfully testing those. Yeah, that's a very, very great scenario for that as well.
Absolutely. Testing SCPs is one of the things that a lot of people struggle with, and this can really help streamline your approach for building a really nice testing framework for that.
Okay, cool. So is there anything to add about this recipe, about the IAM policy simulator, or did we cover the important parts?
Well, we do in the validation checks show how a EC2 describe instances is allowed, and we do give the expected output of that allow with the text of the book, and similarly on our GitHub for this recipe. So EC2 read-only access does permit the EC2 describe instances command to run, and so it's nice to see the allow, but also why it's allowed. It's telling us that the IAM policy is actually allowing that read to happen. So we give both a deny and an allow, and you can see both and how they might come together.
And not only, you know, I think a good thing to call out too is the line and column, the start and stop of what is allowing that. So if it was allowed, and in our example, maybe we didn't want it to be allowed, we could really pinpoint where that was and go in and take it out quickly.
Mm-hmm. So you get debugging information out of that as well, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next recipe I found in your book and that I want to ask you about is you have a recipe for automatically scanning images in ECR. So as far as I understand the problem, when you containerize your application, you store the container images probably on ECR because that's the most convenient service to deploy them on AWS later. But similar to an Amazon machine image in AMI, you want to know when things inside the container contain any security vulnerabilities. So the question is, how do you make sure you get notified about those? So I'm really looking forward to walking us through the solution.
Absolutely. So scanning container images is a really good practice to increase your security posture, especially when you're building pipelines and automation and you're routinely pushing images. Being able to have the image scanned and get a result back with all of the CVSS scores is really really powerful. So you could potentially fail a build if you don't meet a certain security posture. So what we present is a quite simple scenario. We have a container image that we want to push to a repository, and we want to have the image scanned immediately on push and then have the results returned to us. And so with that, we create an ECR repository, and then we change the configuration after we create the repository to say the image scanning configuration scan on push equals true, and we provide the CLI command for that. Within the context of this recipe, we actually have readers pull an old version of the Nginx official container image, which we know to have some medium score vulnerabilities in, and we have them use that to just retag and push to the repository to validate that the scanning configuration on push worked. And so going through those steps, we have five steps here total. It probably takes just a couple minutes to run through for a reader. Once that image is pushed to ECR, we show the reader how to use the describe image scan findings command to then report back what the security vulnerabilities of that image are.
I think it's a great example of taking some preparation steps. In this case, the preparation step we have is, just creating an ECR repo and then modifying it. So it'll work if you don't have an ECR repo. We'll walk you through those steps to create one. But it will also work if you have an existing ECR repo to see how you can modify it with a CLI command to then scan images on push. And then I love seeing in the book the example outputs. So you're going to see what you would expect on your CLI, the output to let you know that the command worked or did not work.
Absolutely, that's really great. So so basically the recipe that you describe is whenever you push a new image to the repository, it automatically gets scanned. So this could again be part of a deployment pipeline. So after you have been building and pushing your image, you could wait for those checks to complete and validate the results. So do you also have a challenge for this example?
Yeah, this example, we actually give the reader two challenges. In some cases, we couldn't narrow the possibilities down. We just thought it was really fun to come up with some of the challenges and try them out ourselves. So the first challenge we said was remediate the vulnerability by updating the image with the latest Nginx container image. And so presumably a reader would pull the latest or a known good copy of the Nginx container image and tag it, push it, and then check the results to see that the vulnerabilities that were initially described have then gone away. The second challenge that we have readers go through is configuring an SNS topic to send you an email when vulnerabilities are detected in your repository. So that's a pretty powerful challenge to have there in terms of maintaining your posture while you might be running a certain container image in your environment. If a new vulnerability comes out, you could potentially receive an email describing that vulnerability to let you take action and update your Dockerfile dependencies or whatever might have been found.
Very good, very good. So actually I've configured an SNS topic for those kinds of notifications myself as well to get notified about those checks. So one thing about how does all that work behind the scenes. So do you know how the ECR scanning works? So how do they create the reports that are coming out of the check? Do we have any insights into that?
We do. In our discussion, we talk about the database that that is used behind the scenes. It's based on the open source CLAIRE project. We provide a link to the documentation there in the discussion of this recipe. So it is using a good source of truth from the open source CLAIRE project.
One warning we call out is this is not a continuous scan. So we would just, one, recommend that you don't use old versions of Nginx. Of course, we were just using that old version to create the warning. But, you know, we'd really encourage everybody to routinely trigger a push, which would trigger this automatic scan. There is a way also to cause a manual scan to occur if you're looking for that, you know, point in time validation.
Yes, I think as far as absolutely that's important, because when you have a container image running and you do not deploy any changes to it, you will never notice that maybe some vulnerability has come up for the container image that you're using. So running those checks frequently is definitely advisable. I don't know, is there a built-in way to do so nowadays, or is it still something you have to come up with yourself as a Lambda function or something similar to trigger that?
Not exactly sure if there's a built-in way to do that right now, to schedule a routine scan.
Because I remember having implemented, I think, something with Lambda or something similar that triggers those checks from time to time. That's, for example, one possible workaround for that to make sure you're getting notified about the running image. And then you can just trigger a scan for the image that's currently running in test and production or something like that. That was helpful for the scenario that I implemented. Is there anything to add about this recipe about scanning container images on ECR, or did we cover everything important here?
I think we covered everything. Again, we provide some cleanup steps to remove the image that was pushed and also delete the repository if you had created one for the purposes of this recipe. And so your environment's returned back to the way it was.
Okay, perfect. So I really enjoyed those two recipes so far, and I think we have time for a third one, do we?
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. So, so because I found another one that is really interesting, and I think this is definitely something that is lesser known. It is about redacting personally identifiable information from text, and I've never heard about that solution. So I'm really looking forward for you talking me through that. So how does that work, and when do I need it?
Yeah, this is a fun one. So Comprehend, powerful service. This is in chapter 8 of the book. So really, we present a problem stating that you have a document with potential personally identifiable information in it, and you'd like to remove the PII before more processing of the document occurs. And so we propose the solution to create some sample data and store it in an S3 bucket, and then launch an Amazon Comprehend job to detect and redact PII entries. and then you can review the results from Amazon Comprehend.
And this is a great recipe, as you mentioned, to show some advanced capability. But going back to one of our earlier points about how we learned while we were writing the book, one of the challenges with this recipe was we need personally identifiable information. We need PII. I wasn't going to put my social security number out there or my information. So we found a really great Python project called Faker. So we were able to use that to just install and generate test data. So we walked the reader through how to do that. So everybody's going to have their own fake data that then they would upload to the S3 bucket for the Comprehend job to scan.
Yeah, awesome. We do give some preparation steps here when we start going through the recipe. Really, it's having the readers create a S3 bucket they can use for this example. And so once the bucket's created, we actually go through and we create an IAM role for Comprehend to be able to interact with our bucket. And so we walk the reader through going through those steps. Once the sample data is up on the S3 bucket, we can start a PII entities detection job with Comprehend. And that might sound complicated, but we break it down into a one-line command. And so what we're doing is telling Comprehend to detect bank account numbers, bank routing, credit debit numbers, credit debit CVV, and several other types of PII. And we actually give that entire config command to readers to go through. So you could customize this to your needs or just run against every PII entity type.
And I think one line that we call out with a tip here is that, are we trying to redact the PII or are we trying to detect it? So two different use cases. One would be if this information needs to be processed downstream and it cannot include PII, then we will redact it so that my name, for example, would still be present, but not my social security number. However, if we have a document and we just want to determine yes, no, is there PII on it, PII included in the document, we can detect it as well. So pretty powerful what we could do just with one command and changing a few options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like the recipe. So it works, you walk you through the steps, step by step, the different commands that you have to execute to prepare the data, to call the AWS CLI to make that happen. So it's really straightforward and shows you really in a really impressive way what you can do with the Comprehend service. I didn't know about that you can remove personal identifier information, because I think that's sometimes very useful. For example, if you have to prepare test data for a test environment, you might be required to remove all that information before you use it for testing purposes, something like that. That's really, really interesting. Okay. So what did we miss? So basically, the recipe is about setting everything up, preparing the data, starting the job, and then also validating the results, I would assume. Is that?
Yeah, you got it. And the challenge we mentioned here is similar to my point before about the challenge we have is to label the type of PII. So not only can it detect PII, but then label the type so that you can make decisions based upon it. So that's pretty powerful. And I like what Mike said about our preparation step, the unique S3 bucket name, which of course is needed so everybody is not using the same S3 bucket. But I think that's a great example of one of the quick one-liners that we included. It was a little bit overkill, but for our unique names, our unique suffixes, we use the secrets manager get random password, of course, because it's an AWS book. There are other ways to do that, of course, in the CLI, but I was happy to know that Secrets Manager provided a CLI command to just get random passwords, and we were able to utilize it for the book. So just another really interesting tidbit, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what else is important, or what else did you find out while diving into that topic? What other areas of AWS or what other features are interesting when it comes to working with personally identifiable information?
Well, certainly there's the ability to take this and modify it and scale it for jobs that you might have that are you know, new and predictable. But if you have to do this at scale, some customers are using Amazon Macy to do this. It's a really powerful service that you can point at your entire S3 estate, if you will, or your data lake, if you want to call it that, to detect PII within. So Macy can do that at a very large scale. So something really interesting to look at if you are a large company that needs this type of capability.
Thanks a lot for sharing those recipes from the AWS cookbook with us. So as promised, I will add the details about the examples that we have been going through, of course, about the book and where you can buy it as well, to the show notes. Is there anything else you want to add, you want to share before I'm closing this episode?
One quick thought I had, and we really appreciate the time here to go through these, again, free recipes that we'll link to, and we hope if you like them, you might consider the book. But we also use the CDK in a lot of recipes to create or prepare an environment for the readers to work a recipe in. And especially with the recent release of the CDK version 2, it's really been a pleasure to use it to programmatically create infrastructure and then interact with it. So an example might be if we had a recipe that where we wanted to show readers how to encrypt an existing RDS database. Well, of course, that assumes they have an existing RDS database, and we didn't want the reader to spend a lot of time creating that. We were able to use the CDK to prepare those environments and then show the reader a way to interact with that environment that was created. So I think it's a really powerful pattern, and I just hope that the readers can consider it.
Perfect. Thank you very much for sharing that. That's a very great way to basically prepare the environments. I really like that. Okay. So thank you very much, Mike and John, for joining me for this podcast episode. It was a pleasure to talk to you, to learn about how you wrote the book and also about the recipes in it. I really like the format. I think it's a very useful book. You will learn something out of it. I'm 100% sure. Even I found a lot of chapters, a lot of recipes that were very interesting. So thanks a lot for joining, and I wish you a huge success with this book.
Thank you so much, and good luck with volume 3 of yours.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. So did you learn something new by listening to this podcast episode? Then tell your friends and coworkers about it. Also, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find our contact details in the show notes. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon. Bye.